Well, good morning, and I'm conscious that not everyone was able to be here last night, and some of what I am about to say assumes a little of what we were talking about last night, and so give me a minute or so just to summarize that so that we can segue into the topic that I want us to think about this morning. Last night, we were asking the question, what happens 5 minutes after you are dead? Where are you and in what state are you in? And we wanted to address that in such a fashion that we could say with Jesus to the dying thief, today you will be with me in paradise. Or Paul's language in Philippians chapter 1, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord, and a similar language of being home and away, at home in the body and away from the Lord in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and that's where we were last evening. And we were talking about heaven in the sense of the intermediate state. And Christians sometimes get this a little confused in their thinking, that when they think about heaven, they're sometimes thinking simply about the intermediate state. What happens when we die and we go to be with Jesus? And that's true, and that's wonderfully true, and it's an incredibly precious truth for believers. But this morning, I want us to ask a slightly different question. What is heaven ultimately like? And the Bible sometimes will refer to this as the new heavens and the new earth. And we're talking about what is it going to be like after the second coming? Now, we won't get into all kinds of discussion about eschatology and premillennial and postmillennial and amillennial issues, and the interpretation of Revelation 20 and the 1,000 years, and what will the earth be like before Jesus comes or after Jesus comes, and is there any future whatsoever for Israel as an entity, as a race, as an ethnic body, or as a body politic? Was 1947 and the formation of the State of Israel significant prophetically? We're not going to go into any of that. We're way past all that. And we're asking, what is it going to be like after all of that, whatever that is, after all of that is accomplished and done and dusted, then what? What's it going to be like? And I want to pick up just as a means of getting into this topic. I want to go, first of all, to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11, and this is one of the Christmas passages. And this has been bothering me ever since I came in last night. First of all, what's the deal with only one tree not being lit? So, is this a Trinity statement that's gone wrong? Anyway, it's been bothering me. I'm trying to put it in the back of my head here, but I keep thinking, is this a kind of subordinationist statement? And who is is it the Son or the Holy Spirit who's subordinate? And Is this Eastern Orthodoxy and a denial of the procession of the Holy Spirit? So I'm just visiting. I'm just asking. Maybe you just didn't pay your light bill, and this is all you could afford. So maybe we need to take up a collection. Anyway. Isaiah chapter 11, it was Christmas that got me onto that. Isaiah chapter 11, and at the first verse, There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. And Jesse, of course, has significance because of David and the Davidic promise and the Davidic covenant and so on. And as Isaiah is thinking ahead and in terms of the exile, which is 150 years in his future, he foresees here a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. I lived in a house in Belfast early in my ministry when I wasn't paid what I'm paid now, and things were a little tight. That's an understatement. And there was a tree in my backyard. It wasn't a big yard, but the tree was significant. And it needed to be, well, it just needed to come down. And I couldn't afford to pay somebody to come and take it down. I thought I would do it myself. And I didn't have a chainsaw or anything. All I had was a hand saw. And it was a disaster because it fell into my neighbor's yard and broke the fence. And anyway, it was a complete disaster. And I ended up paying more to get rid of the thing than I would have done had I just hired somebody to do it in the first place. But eventually, I sawed it down right to ground level. So there was no evidence of a tree. And I sort of put some soil on the top of it, you know, and covered it. And thought, that's it, done. And I'm done with that. And then in the spring, a shoot started coming up. And more shoots started coming up. And all of a sudden, this tree that I thought was dead was actually alive. And it had leaves and everything. And that's the image that's being used here. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. This Davidic covenant that has, as it in 2 Samuel 7, and deeply, deeply significant in terms of David being king over all the nations, and this worldwide vision of the rule of King David. And Isaiah is prophesying of an era when the line of the monarchy has ended. It has gone, and the Babylonians have taken the last king into exile, and whose sons, you remember, had been killed in front of him, and that's the last thing that he saw was the death of his two sons. And then they blinded him. They put out his eyes and carried him in chains to Babylon, and we never hear anything more about him. And that's the end of the Davidic monarchy. But Isaiah says, a shoot shall come forth from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. And who are these people who keep asking, is the Holy Spirit in the Old Testament? Do you not read the whole Old Testament? It's right here. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. Spirit with a capital S, the Holy Spirit. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. And you understand, he's talking about Jesus here. And then this wonderful little cameo, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy, in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. I have simple tastes. I'm not a complex kind of person. I see one movie a year, maybe two. I went to see Murder on the Orient Express last week, thought it was wonderful. Kenneth Branagh is a wonderful actor. It was panned in the New York Times, but what do they know? Snobs. So in my downtime, I sometimes will watch YouTube videos because they're free. And you don't have to get a subscription and all that nonsense. And I have my favorites, and after a while, some boffins somewhere get to know what your favorites are. And they come up automatically on your, every time you switch it on, they come up. And they're videos of animals. I'm a sucker for them. I mean, unlikely friendships is one theme on YouTube. And they're a bear and a dog, and they're best friends, and they play together and lie down next to each other, and they play fetch and catch, and I'm a sucker for all that. I watch it, and there's probably one that I've watched 50 times and gets me all the time. Never get tired of it. Unlikely friendships. A parrot and a cat. And who are they? Maybe it's you. So just keep quiet. Just don't say anything. But maybe you've got a parrot and a cat, and they're best friends. Who'd have thought? Not my cat, that's for sure. And you've got this picture here. The wolf shall lie down with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. And what is this? And there are those who say that this is an example of perhaps apocalyptic literature, and that this is a picture. C.S. Lewis once signed a child's book in a bookstore and said, among other things, don't believe in anything that can't be told in colored pictures. And this is a colored picture. And a colored picture of a post-millennial earth, that before Jesus comes, the world will be filled with Christians. When I went to seminary in the last century, which it was, if you'd have asked at my class, and we're talking a class of about 35 or 40 students, and if you'd have asked my class, how many of you are post-millennial? That is to say, how many of you believe that before Jesus comes, the earth will be filled with Christianity? Just that general sort of statement. Probably 75 to 80% of the class would have put their hands up and said yes. If I ask my class today in 2017, how many of you are post-millennial, not a single hand goes up. That's an enormous change that's taken place in my lifetime. That postmillennialism is not the flavor of the month anymore. And it's fascinating to me for another time to ask, why is that so? What happened? What happened in the church? What happened in the world? What made people so pessimistic about the gospel? And maybe that's not fair to use the word pessimistic, because you're amillennial or whatever you are, or premillennial, or do we have any dispensationalists here? We just won't go in there. Whatever you are on the eschatological bandwidth, it's tough to be a post-millennialist in 2017. But this passage, among other passages, was a key passage that was understood as signifying that this is a picture of the end before Jesus comes. So the gospel is going to spread to all the world and millions and millions and millions in that last generation or two, maybe. And questions, I remember in class asking the question that was asked in the 19th century by B.B. Warfield, are there more in heaven than in hell? What? Who asks that question? Are there more in heaven than in hell? Because think about it, at any given point in history, there have been less Christians than non-Christians. I mean, a statistical analysis of any chapter of history will tell you that Christians have always been in the minority, so how can there be more in heaven than in hell? And for some theologians, that was in itself, especially Dutch theologians, that in itself was an indication of the defeat of God's purpose. So in order for God's purpose to be seen, to be victorious, that the death of Christ would seem to be victorious, there had to be more in heaven than in hell. Well, how could that possibly be? Well, one answer, of course, is that every child goes to heaven. And that's a very sensitive issue, and I don't want to go there this morning. But if you add children who die in infancy into that number, statistically, you might get there. But one way of getting there, so people thought, was to say, at the end, the whole world, more or less, will be Christian. Actually, I'm a math major, and that doesn't cut it. It's like trying to make up your pension when you're 58, and you've done nothing. It's not going to work. The math is against you. It's just basic math 101. It's not going to work. It's called compound interest. And this doesn't work either. So what is this a picture of? And the prevailing view these days, at least in Reformed circles, is that this is a picture not of the earth before Jesus comes, but it's a view of the earth after Jesus comes. It's a view of heaven, if you want to use that language, but it's what the world, the cosmos, the universe is going to look like in eternity. And so is this real, or is this just a picture? Is this a picture of it's going to be beautiful and friendly and nice and cuddly and warm, and there are lots of those ooh and ah moments as these pictures have wolves and lions and goats, which normally is lunch, you understand, lying down together and playing together, and this is a picture of just harmony and the restoration of harmony into a universe that is currently disordered because of sin and the fall and so on. Well, I'll let you ponder that for a minute, and because this is where we're going. But so that was number one. Turn to 2 Peter. Second Peter chapter 3 and verses 10 through 13. 2 Peter 3, 10 through 13. And now Peter is using a technical phrase, the day of the Lord, and this is an Old Testament phrase. And the day of the Lord can mean different things in the Old Testament, and the day of the Lord can be the coming of Jesus and the inauguration of the new covenant and Pentecost and the dawning of new covenant blessings. And the day of the Lord can also mean the day of judgment and as a prophetic foreshortening of something that is actually separated from the dawning of the new covenant, that it's actually separated by, let's say, thousands of years, but from the Old Testament. And when you look at two things from a distance, actually they look as if they're on top of each other, but actually they're not. And so there's that prophetic foreshortening taking place. The day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burnt up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done in it will be exposed. And there are many issues here, but I want to refer to just one of them, and that is, this is a picture of the end. And Peter is suggesting that at the end, This world, this cosmos, is going to be burnt up. And at the time of the Reformation in the 16th century, Lutherans and Calvinists had a little bit of a spat on this issue. Because Lutherans said, yes, this world is going to be burnt up. It's going to be destroyed, and God's going to make a new world. And there are consequences if you think like that. If you think like that this world is going to be burnt up and destroyed, you're not going to have a lot of emotional investment in this world. What's the point if it's going to be burnt up? So the tendency of that view is to sort of distance yourself from the world a little, and you may not escape into a monastery or into the deserts and sort of live a sort of reclusive life, but you are going to have some suspicion about involvement in the world that's tangible and physical, and your hands are getting dirty because it's God's world. No, this is a fallen world and it's Satan's world and it's going to be burnt up and Jesus is going to destroy it. But the Calvinists said, no, that's not true. There's nothing wrong with the world itself. Creation is cursed, but creation itself isn't sin. So atoms and molecules and the force of gravity is not in itself sinful. This is part of God's creation, part of his handiwork. And we all have those moments when we think like that. So last week, or was it the week before? When was Thanksgiving? Feels like last year. But it wasn't so long ago. It was just last week, or was it? Anyway, I was in Colorado and with my son and wife, and we drove to Pikes Peak, 14,100 feet, hairpin bends, no fences or anything. My wife was really nervous. I thought she was going to break the door handle. She was holding onto it so tightly. And there's a moment in my wife's metabolism that she doesn't speak, but you can hear the intake of breath. And you just know that you've done something or you're getting close to doing something that she disapproves of. And then we got on the top and it was absolutely breathtaking. And Psalm 19 just sort of explodes in your head. And this is God's world, this is God's earth, and it's beautiful. Yes, down below there somewhere there's all kinds of mess and pain and hurt, but up here where I was, it just looked absolutely beautiful, and it was hard to imagine it looking any more beautiful. I mean, what more could God do to make it look even more beautiful? So although the world is cursed and thorns and thistles and so on, and the curse of Genesis 3, and yet, the earth declares the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth his handiwork, and so on. So God isn't going to destroy this world. He's going to restore this world. And so there are those two different opinions, and when you view the world as God's world, you don't want to distance yourself necessarily by views of spirituality that say there's me and there's church and then there's something else and that's all ungodly. But actually, this is God's world. And it's okay to fish and play golf and do stuff that people do. Enjoy music and a little story. I don't preach like this. This is a conference. We're doing something different here. I don't tell lots of stories when I'm preaching. Just want you to know that. I believe in expository preaching, but conferences are a little different, and so a little story. I grew up obsessed with classical music. I mean, completely obsessed with it. My grandfather died when I was 5, and he had a fabulous classical music collection. And the week before he died, he had cancer, and he'd been ill for a long time. But the week before he died, he called all 4 of his grandchildren in to see him one by one. And I'm 5 years old, and he called me in to see him, and this was 2 days before he died. And I'm there, I forget, but I was probably there for 15 or 20 minutes or so, and he had things he wanted to tell me, and some of it was private, and I've not disclosed much of that, but he gave me a present. He gave all the grandchildren a present, a gift, and he gave me a fountain pen. It was a green Parker fountain pen, and he told me to write a book. I want you to write a book. I'm five. And he said, because one of my earliest memories is sitting on his knee listening to Puccini's La Bohème, and he realized that I was the only one of the four grandchildren that had any hope whatsoever of liking classical music, which is still true today. And I inherited his record collection. I didn't actually get them until I was 15. My grandmother kept them for me, and on my 15th birthday, I received them. And we're talking 500-600 LPs, and they were the best. And then, about 6 months after I was saved, I met a man who mentored me for a short time, who told me I needed to get rid of them all. And they were a distraction and a stumbling block, and they were worldly, and I just needed to get rid of them. So the next day, I took them in boxes to a thrift store, and I got rid of them for like $5, and I've regretted it ever since. And that was, 45 years ago or more, and I've regretted it ever since. And I wish I could get them back, not least because they were my grandfather's, and there's a sentimental value attached to them, and so on. But it was part of that view that says this world and all that it contains is ungodly, and you shouldn't have anything to do with it. And godliness means separation from this world. And there's absolutely nothing ungodly about sitting down and listening to Mahler's First Symphony, which actually is about creation. And even though Mahler himself might have been skewed in terms of his world and life view, and he was a Jew who became Roman Catholic out of convenience more than anything else, but who knows where he was, but he had a gift of music, and it's okay for Christians to enjoy and celebrate that gift, because it's God's gift. And God distributes those gifts to Christians and non-Christians. And we see, even in the works and hands and of non-Christians, something of his beauty. So we need to ask, what does Peter mean here by the destruction? And does he actually mean, literally, the destruction of the universe, and that everything's going to be obliterated and God's going to start all over again? And I think that's not correct. So the third passage is Revelation 21 and 1 to 4. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Now, we won't go there now for time's sake, but in the last two chapters of Isaiah 65 and Isaiah 66, Isaiah introduces us to that language of a new heavens and a new earth. And John picks it up here in Revelation 21. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away." So I want us to ask, what is heaven like? And I'm asking a question now, not about the intermediate state, not what happens when you die, not that part. I'm asking, what is heaven ultimately like? And the first thing I want to say is this, that it's a new earth. It's a new heaven and a new earth, or sometimes in the plural, new heavens and earth. Earth. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament see and anticipate a restoration of creation to its former glory as it was in Eden before the fall, and then some. An affirmation of the natural order. Now, that's a huge statement, and it's an important statement because it flies in the face of a lot of things. And Plato's view of forms, for example, the idea is the real, and what you see and touch is not the real, and that is 180 from what the Bible is saying here. But that view, and Plato's view of forms, has affected Christianity considerably, and the Manichaeans, for example, in the time of Augustine, and Augustine himself for a period was affected by touch not, taste not, handle not. He had led such a profligate life as a teenager and a young man, a sexually profligate life, that I don't think he ever recovered from it. And I think the Roman Catholic Church for 1,000 years was in bondage because of Augustine's view of touch not, taste not, handle not. And a Manichaean celibacy is to be preferred before marriage and so on. All of that gets skewed into Christianity throughout the Middle Ages, all because of Augustine. Right? That's a big statement to make, and I don't have time to expand on it. It manifests itself in the church when you ask the question, the Christmas question, who is he in yonder stall? At whose feet the shepherds fall. There's a dark shadow here, but this is not a step, right? Okay, I just need to make sure of that. From where I'm, it's a lighting thing. So let me ask you a question. You're in Galilee at the time of Jesus, and you're in Nazareth, say. And Jesus and the disciples are hanging around outside the synagogue in Nazareth, and the synagogue is still there. And if you do a tour of Nazareth, you'll be taken to the synagogue, and apparently the stones on the floor go back to the first century. You either believe that or you don't, and when you're there, you want to believe it for sure. And so Jesus is sort of, he walks off to the side a little, and you think, this is my moment. I'm just going to go up to him, and I'm going to ask him. I'm going to ask him this question, because it's really bugging me. So you come up to Jesus, and you say to him, can you sing the opening notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony? Da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da. Well, first of all, Jesus would say, excuse me, I don't understand what you're saying. What is this language you're speaking? Because he doesn't speak English. He spoke Aramaic. He knew Hebrew. He probably understood Greek. He might have had a smattering of Latin, though there's no evidence of that. But he most certainly did not speak English. So he wouldn't have understood a word you said. Had he understood, and you provide a translation, he wouldn't know who Beethoven is. And he wouldn't know what a symphony is. So the answer is no. He couldn't sing the opening notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And now you're a little puzzled, and some of you are a little shocked, and now you're saying, but Jesus is God, right? That's the default. You've already said Jesus is God, so he knows everything. So let me ask you another question. Jesus, I've always wondered, you know, and forgive me for asking, and I mean it in sincerity. There's not a trick question or anything, and I don't mean to sound arrogant or disrespectful in any way, but can you tell me the chemical formula for benzene, which is C6H6? And again, he wouldn't understand your question because you're asking it in English for the second time. And no, he does not know the chemical formula for benzene. And some of you are saying, well, but he's God and he knows everything. And yes, he is God and he knows everything in his divine mind, but we're not asking what does he know in his divine mind, because he knows everything in his divine mind. We're asking in his human mind. The baby lying in the manger, how much did he know? I mean, had he read Tolkien? I mean, did he know what happened to Sam and Frodo? Did he know that Gandalf stood there on the bridge of Khazad Dûm and said, "You shall not pass"? No, he didn't know any of that stuff. Did Jesus go to the bathroom? Of course. But if you have a reluctance in answering that question, your incarnation isn't complete. And what we're talking about here is the completeness of the incarnation. That Jesus was a human being. He was male, not female. He certainly wasn't androgynous. He wasn't a metrosexual. He was a man. And that has consequences. So that view of wanting to distance Christianity from the world, wanting to distance Christianity from atoms and molecules, wanting to distance Christianity from the crass physicality, and what that means, that's still in the church. I would be shocked if it wasn't in this room, right? And some of you are still puzzling. Of course Jesus knew the formula of benzene. Who doesn't know the formula of benzene? A new earth. I create a new earth. New, and here, Greek, when I went to seminary, Greek made a distinction between neos and kainos. New, meaning brand new, meaning altogether new, or new, meaning refashioned and remodeled and restored. And the word used here is the restored one. So let me ask a second question. New earth. What's heaven like? And I get asked that question, what is heaven like? And I usually answer the question by saying, first of all, are you talking about the intermediate state or are you talking about the final state? And if they're talking about the intermediate state, I usually answer the question very pastorally, because they're thinking about death and they're thinking about perhaps the death of a loved one or their own death, and I need to answer that pastorally and give an assurance that if they believe in Jesus and they're justified by faith alone in Jesus Christ alone, they will be in paradise 5 seconds after they die. And they'll be self-aware and self-conscious and aware of their surroundings, and they'll be singing and dancing and talking and feeling and lots of other things. But if they're asking about the end state, the final state, I'll say something like this. I'll say, it's like this. If you can imagine this without sin, and that's a stretch, but if you can imagine this without sin, so if there was no sin, would there be bricks? If there is no sin, would there be grass? If there's no sin, would there be trees? If there's no sin, would there be rivers? if there's no sin, would there be stars and planets and asteroids and Milky Ways and stuff? And the answer is yes, of course. So let me ask it in this way. Are there dogs in heaven? Now, some of you weren't here last night, so I went on a dog trail. And those of you here last night will know that I love dogs. And I met a dog last night, and she was delightful. Beautiful dog. She was here. And I have two dogs, and they're a mess, and they're both rescues. And I've had dogs that I've had intense conversations with. Jake, who is now dead, I had him for 14 years, and he was a supralapsarian. And this is an issue involving the logical order of the decrees, and does the decree of election assume a decree of a permission to allow man to fall? And the supralapsarians say no, that the decree of election has priority over the decree to permit the fall. And that's quite a hard-nosed sort of position to take, and Reformed theologians have been on either side of that issue. And I'm currently involved in the republication of the works of William Perkins that haven't been published since around 1600 or so. And there are 10 volumes, and volume 4 or 5 is about to hit the shelves. And William Perkins was a hard-nosed supralapsarian. And I lay down beside my dog every night. I'd get out of bed because he would be on the floor beside the bed. And he was an 85-pound lab mix rescue. And sweet, sweet Jake that he was. And he'd be fast asleep and snoring. And I would shake him and I'd say, "Wake up, I need to ask you a question." And he would open half an eye and I would say, "Are you a supralapsarian?" And his tail would start. So he knew exactly what I was asking and affirmed that he was not some lily-livered Calvinist. He was the hardcore Calvinist. He was a supralapsarian, that the order of the decrees was the priority of the decree of election. My current two dogs, I've not quite grasped the intricacies of the debate on the lapsarian issue. And Gracie just responds by licking you, no matter what you ask her. So are there dogs in heaven? And I've been asked this question hundreds of times in my ministry by people who have dogs and love dogs, and people who don't have dogs just think that you're crazy and really question a whole lot about you psychologically and theologically that you ask this question. But I actually think that it's an important question. Are there dogs in heaven? Now, I don't know whether your dog is in heaven. That's not my point. I can pontificate, and I have an answer that suits me, and I think I can justify it biblically from a theological understanding of the kindness of God and the kinds of things that God does and the argument for restoration. So the answer to the question, are there dogs in heaven, is of course. It's a really dumb question. Because everything that God has created is going to be in the new heavens and new earth. God isn't in the business of destruction. So are there going to be dinosaurs in heaven? You know, is T-Rex going to be in the new heavens and new earth? And my answer is yes. I fully expect to see it somewhere. I hope it's on an island somewhere. And there'll be visits that you can make, you know, to see it and keep it a distance because they're big. Yes. I think it's an important question. Now, I ask, are there dogs in heaven rather than are there cats in heaven? Because that kind of gets into difficult places. And I've had cats all my life and have one at the minute, but I'm not sure about her. and there's a mean streak that somehow I'm not sure I can reconcile that. But the question, are there dogs in heaven, is actually a very, very serious question. I approach it in a jocular fashion here to try and win you over a little. But I want you to seriously think theologically and biblically about the new heavens and new earth, because the new heavens and new earth is restorative. And it's a restoration of the messianic rule of the king, the wonderful counselor, the mighty God, the everlasting father, the prince of peace, who has conquered sin and death and the grave, and will reverse the effects of the curse. So I fully expect a restoration of all of God's creation, including extinct species. Well, that's exciting to look forward to. In my Father's house are many mansions. So what do you think about? You think about the White House? What do you think about? Why would you need a mansion? Because you have a body, and you need somewhere to live, and you need somewhere to sleep. Will we eat food? It's an interesting question. You know, Jesus ate fish in his resurrection body. He didn't actually eat the 153 fish that the disciples had caught. What a lesson for Peter, by the way. The one thing he had failed as a disciple, so he couldn't do that. So he went back to the one thing he knew he could do, and that was fish. And he caught nothing. That's beautiful. God has a sense of humor. You know, when God doesn't want you to do something, he's going to make it really tough. Right? He's going to make you really stink. I mean, something that you brag to the guys about, that you have these talents and so on, and God doesn't want you to do that. He wants you to do something else, and you're going to fail, and you're going to fail miserably and publicly. And Peter failed. And then Jesus says, you know, put down your net on the other side, and it's full of fish, just like that. And then if you read the narrative closely, you'll see that Jesus already has fish cooking. It's not the one of the 153. He's already gone and got fish somewhere and started cooking them. And they have breakfast together. And presumably, Jesus ate breakfast. He digested food in a resurrection body. Now, there are consequences. We won't go there. But there are if you eat, there are consequences in a resurrection body. And was that just a temporary thing, that the body of Jesus after the ascension is another body again, a different kind of body to the resurrection body? And there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that that is so. That when Jesus disappeared into a cloud, I was teaching the doctrine of the resurrection in a seminary class a few years ago, and I was at that point, and we were talking about the importance of the doctrine of the ascension. A statement that we affirm every week in the Apostles' Creed, at least in our church, but we hear very little talk about the ascension, and the ascension is a major significant doctrine in the New Testament. It's as a result of the ascension of Jesus that the Holy Spirit is poured forth. He gave gifts to men. Having ascended up on high, he gave gifts to men. Equips the church to do the work of ministry because of the ascension. And the ascension is like promotion, and we use the language all the time that somebody's gone up in the world, meaning he's been promoted. And Jesus went up in the world. He went up into a cloud. So a seminary student looked puzzled, and I said, what's wrong? And he asked the question, how could he breathe? I said, excuse me? He said, well, if he ascended to the clouds, and I think in his mind he had a vision like Superman. You know, and he just went up, you know, and disappeared into a cloud, and there's no oxygen, or little oxygen. How does he breathe? And I thought, that's a really good question. It's a little nerdy, but it's a really good question. And I said, just think low clouds. And maybe he ascended a mountain of sorts, and there were low clouds, and that's how he disappeared. He didn't go up like a rocket, like Superman. He climbed up a hill and into the clouds, and he was gone, and he disappeared. Maybe. I'm not sure. But the instinct to ask the question, how could he breathe, was a good question, because Jesus breathes. So where is Jesus right now? We asked this question last night. Where is Jesus right now? And he's somewhere in space and time. His physical body exists somewhere in space and time. And wherever he is, there's oxygen. Right? There's oxygen. So he's not on the moon because he couldn't breathe. And that sounds a little strange and a little weird, and C.S. Lewis spoke about Jesus' body going through a fold in space. C.S. Lewis had an interest in science fiction and so on. So he's disappeared into a fold in space. But he's somewhere in creation, and he's returning into creation. And when he returns, we shall see him, and we shall see his face. And presumably we'll be able to touch him. Now, he will not be ubiquitous, not now and not then. He can't be in two places at one time. Jesus was never in Michigan. What gives here? He was never in Michigan, ever. Contrary to the Mormons, he was never in North America, ever. In his divine nature, he is everywhere. He's right here. He's in this room. He's outside of us. He's inside of us. He's everywhere. But in his human nature, he can only be in one place at any one time. So in the new heavens and new earth, what are you going to do? Will there be exploration and inquiry and investigation? Think of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Not all of it was paradise. There were places to explore and places to conquer and to build and so on. And God makes a creation that's perfect, that's without sin, but it's not paradise. And are we to understand the new heavens and new earth to be like that? Or is it all going to be finished, and we're just going to look there and wonder and say, it's all done, finished, beautiful, beautiful, 10,000 years later, beautiful, beautiful, million years later, it's beautiful, beautiful, 18 million years, it's still beautiful. Is that the new heavens and new earth? Or is it exploration? An investigation. When you die, are you suddenly, are tons and tons of information going to be downloaded into your brain, and suddenly you just become omniscient and you know everything? So that book that you said you were going to read, when you get to heaven, you'll have read it, because it's just in your brain now. Is that how it's going to be? Or are you going to say, finally, you're going to go up to Ezekiel and you're going to say to him, I never got around to reading your book. I knew you were important, and you were a major prophet, and it's wonderful to meet you, and you did some weird things, and did you really eat poop? Really? And if you're wondering why I'm saying that, you haven't read the book of Ezekiel. And you'll be saying to him, I'm going to read that book. I'm going to read it tonight. Is that our picture of the new heavens and new earth? And I think it is. I think that's what it is. I think it's about investigation and exploration and creativity and anticipation, and we will be the kind of creatures that God always intended us to be. And part of the image of God that is now restored is the image of creativity. So you're going to create things. You want to play golf in heaven, and I see absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. Are you going to be a perfect golfer in heaven? Probably not. I think you're still going to have to learn You've got a long time to learn it. And God's going to give different gifts, just as he does here. Even there, there'll be different gifts. I don't know the answer to this. I rest on God's kindness. And there are certain gifts I wish I had. I don't have them here, but I wish I had them. And I'm going to ask for them when I get there. I want to play the piano. I look at a piano and it's a mystery to me. I just want to play the piano. I want to be able to sit down and do what he does. And play without looking at the keys. And play in a way that's harmonious. Although I understand discord in music, but that's not my point. I want us to think about heaven in a way that isn't platonic. I want us to think about heaven in a way that isn't just floating on clouds and playing harps and seeing angels. I want us to think of heaven in the way the Bible speaks about heaven, in terms of a new heavens and a new earth, with all that that entails. You know, there are some interesting questions. You know, there's no sex in heaven, so Jesus says. There's no marriage in heaven. There's no procreation in heaven. And however difficult and disappointing that may sound to some of you, God, I'm sure, has ways of making that up, and whatever that is going to be even more wonderful and astonishing. But that, too, is part of his creation. Another thing to be thought of in a negative way, but a thing to be thought of in a positive way, and a thing for which we should give thanks to God for as biblical Christians. But eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those that love him. Now, the clock is saying I'm supposed to stop here, right? Yes, okay. There's more. And we'll pick it up in the third session. But let me pray. Father, we thank you as we just scratch away at the surface of these passages in Isaiah 11 and 2 Peter 3 and Revelation 21, and we wonder what is ahead for us, ultimately ahead for us. And it sounds wonderful and almost incredible. And we can dream about it. And it all sounds so marvelous, a gift that you've given to us. And all because we believe in Jesus, because he paid it all. All to him we owe. Sin had left a crimson stain, but he washed it white as snow. So teach us, guide us, direct us, we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.